Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. My guest Steve Buscemi doesn't need that much of an introduction. He is one of the most memorable actors ever. He's had hundreds of parts, leading parts in stuff like Reservoir Dogs, Ghost World, Boardwalk Empire, iconic supporting parts in Fargo, The Sopranos, and of course 30 Rock. So we'll skip the long intro and talk about his newest work. It's a TV show called Miracle Workers, a comedy created by the hilarious Simon Rich, the same person behind Man Seeking Woman and a bunch of brilliantly written works you might have seen in The New Yorker or on one of his many books or heard on this show. Each season, Miracle Workers tells a different story with the same cast. Season one was set in Heaven, which is run kind of like a soulless megacorporation with an absentee CEO. Steve played God. Literally, God.
Explain cows.
I don't want to do this anymore.
Tell Mom and Dad what a cow is.
It's like a big dog you can drink from.
And what's a dog?
A small cow you can be friends with.
Tell them about giraffes. What's a giraffe?
It's just a tall dog with...
Louder. Speak up.
Tall dog with a leg for a neck.
Season two takes place in the Dark Ages. In fact, that's what it's called, Miracle Workers Dark Ages. Steve Buscemi plays a peasant named Edward, whose last name we cannot say on the radio. That's because it describes his profession. He scoops up human waste with a shovel. Shoveler is actually the second word in his last name, and I bet you can guess the first. Let's hear a clip from the show. In this bit, Ed is training his daughter in the family business. They're just about to make their rounds in the village with their shovels and cart, but before she goes off on her own to work, Ed gives her the rundown.
Well, you know the shoveler's pledge. Anytime, anywhere, even if it's big.
That's the pledge?
Yeah. It's easy to remember because it doesn't rhyme. First job, big moment.
Okay, let's just get this over with.
Whoa, easy there, cowboy. I gotta teach you la technique. All right, now, never turn your back on the cart, and always lift from your neck. The neck is the body's power center.
Why are these shovels so short?
Well, this way we have to stoop over more, and it's harder.
But those are negatives.
That's the way my dad taught me. I remember what he said just before he died of shoveling. Son, I feel weird.
Steve Buscemi, welcome to Bullseye. It's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
How did you end up making this very specific television program with the great Simon Rich?
Well, so this is, it's an anthology series. So this is actually the second season. The first season was just called Miracle Workers, and it took place in Heaven, as if Heaven was a corporation. And I played God, and but he's a very disinterested God, not terribly bright, very secluded, kind of depressed, confused about how Earth just all went wrong, and he's ready to give it up. And it's up to his angels to sort of convince him that it's a worthwhile endeavor to keep Earth going.
He's sort of like a sweatpants god.
He is, yeah. He's sort of just kind of gave up.
He's ready to pivot to a restaurant.
He wants to
bail on this.
He wants to destroy the Earth and open up this crazy restaurant somewhere in space. The second season takes place in the Dark Ages, hence the title Miracle Workers, Dark Ages. So it's the same cast. And that was Geraldine Viswanathan that you heard in that clip. And also Daniel Radcliffe is in the series, and John Bass, and Karan Soni. So it's all the same cast, and we all play different characters now. And so if the listeners couldn't tell from that clip, I am the town shoveler.
as evidenced by your surname,
yes,
which, as was the custom at the time,
yes,
reflects directly your occupation.
Yes, and Geraldine plays my daughter, and John Bass plays my son. And Daniel Radcliffe, in the first season, yeah, he played sort of like this helpless angel who's like overwhelmed but in this one he plays a spoiled prince who lives in a castle, and so it's sort of a role reversal for us both.
You bring a lot of kind of casual humanity to this role that otherwise could be very broad. Like, it could be a big goof around.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires you to do these big idea things in the plainest, most human way possible.
Well, if it was just, you know, jokes, I don't think I'd be interested. But what I loved about playing God was that, you know, that he really did have, you know, this inner life that I found very sympathetic, you know, even though he could be the biggest jerk, you know, a lot of the times. And in this season, I loved... I don't usually get to play a dad, you know, and so in this one I have a couple of kids, and he's, you know, he is a pillar of the community. People depend on him, and he's very proud of what he does, and so that was, you know, that was really something that I could hold on to and just always play that.
There is a scene from Miracle Worker's second season that I want to play that I think reflects the esteem in which your character is held by the community. So basically, your character and his daughter are out doing their work, which involves shoveling, and the cart into which they shovel that which they shovel runs into the prince, played by Daniel Radcliffe, and he is not actually injured, but long story short, in order to not embarrass himself in front of his dad, the king,
right,
he orders your character to be executed. And so these are what he believes will be his last words to his kids before his execution.
Just remember this life advice. If you work hard, be kind, everything will always go your way.
Bring out the prison up.
Gotta go.
Dad, why did you take the blame?
For the same reason I do everything. Because I'm your father, and I love you.
I'm so sorry. Everything I said,
it's okay. It's okay. The truth is, you're too smart for this job. You get your brains from your mother. Before she died, I promised her I'd do my best for you. I taught you everything I knew this morning. And I know you'll succeed at whatever you do. Gotta go. And happily he goes.
What's lovely about this character is, like, he has the toughest job that exists in the world, and also does not question any of the tough parts of it. Like, he loves it. He uses like a dustpan to do his shoveling, a wooden dustpan, and is completely taken aback when his daughter suggests maybe they should use a long-handled implement. He's like, well, stooping—that's like part of the thing.
Yeah.
You got to stoop. And he really finds satisfaction in the sort of bounds of his world, that, like, he provides this service, he does this thing, and there's literally a scene where you're walking down the street and you say, could life get any better?
He's, you know, he's working. He's and he's providing for his family, and now his daughter is working with him. It's, life couldn't be better for him.
Your dad was a civil servant. He worked in the sanitation department in New York.
You know, when Simon first told me about my character for this season, as I'm hearing him talk, I said, well, this guy reminds me a lot of my dad. You know, my dad did 30 years on the Department of Sanitation in Brooklyn, and we were well provided for, and you know, he didn't have the most impressive job, you know, that you wanted to brag about to your friends, but I never heard him complain. He just, you know, he really just, and I think he did enjoy what he did. I mean, he later became an assistant foreman and then a foreman, and he passed away about 5 years ago, and at his wake, I got to meet a lot of his friends that he worked with, and just to hear you know, the stories about him and the way that they talked about him and how he really cared about the people that he worked with. And he had a good time at work. And it was a job, but he took it seriously. And I think he felt good that he was able to, you know, he had four kids and he provided well.
Did you go into the civil service, which you did as a young man, in part because of his influence?
It was directly because of him. I mean, he made me and my brothers take whatever civil service exam came up when we turned 18. And for me, it was the fire department. So I took the test really kind of just to please him, but he made sure that I trained for it and he made sure that I was able to get older copies of the written exam, which is the written exam. It's pretty easy, but there's always a couple of like trick questions. And if you don't study the older exams, you won't be ready for them and you'll miss them on the test. And I scored, you know, because of that, I was able to score high on the written exam. I did okay on my physical and my name was put on the list, and it took 4 years for me to get hired. And by that time, I was moving furniture. I was trying to do stand-up. I had moved into the city, and I was just exhausted and just looking for a change. And I thought, okay, I'll be a firefighter, and not really understanding what the job called for. But then, of course, once I took the job, I really fell in love with it, and you know, just really admired the people that I was working with. And I did it for 4 years, and it stayed with me all this time.
Did you think about going to college when you finished high school?
I did. I went to Nassau Community College for one semester and wasn't even taking any theater classes. I was just, you know, taking some liberal arts classes. And it just, I mean, there were a couple of interesting classes that I wished I had, you know, if I could have just taken those classes. There was like a jazz appreciation class, and there was a literature class. But then I also had to take biology and some other things, and I just thought, this is like high school again. And I dropped out after a semester and then figured out that, yeah, I think I do want to be an actor. I had only done a little bit of acting in high school, although it's something that I had always wanted to do when I was a kid, you know. And as a kid, I did school plays, but it wasn't until my senior year in high school that I started to like really check out the theater department. Anyway, I then, again, at the advice of my dad, he said, well, you should take acting classes, you know. But I was living in Long Island. I had no idea that these things even existed, you know. And I ended up going to the Lee Strasberg Institute on a six-month, like a full-time course, like four acting classes a week and a movement class and a speech class. And it was great.
Even more with Steve Buscemi still to come. When we return from a quick break, we'll look back on the first ever movie in which he acted, one that ended up being a pivotal moment in the history of American queer cinema. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month, and all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fan Time.
And I'm Travell Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host. And the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fan Time is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see Black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ew.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm here with the actor Steve Buscemi. He has, of course, performed in literally hundreds of films and TV shows. These days, you can see him on TBS. He stars alongside Daniel Radcliffe in the brilliant comedy series Miracle Workers, Dark Ages. I read this great profile that John Lahr wrote of you for The New Yorker 15 years or so ago. Yeah. And he described your dad encouraging you to take acting classes in a way that I loved reading because, you know, in my job, you hear lots of people describe what their parents' relationships were to their artistic aspirations, right? And basically, you had been hit by a bus when you were a preschooler.
Yeah.
And there was like a little bit of money that was in an educational trust fund.
Right. I got a settlement. Yeah.
And your dad, at least as John Lahr described it, basically said, look, you should take acting lessons. You don't become an actor, but you got to do something.
Well, yeah.
This is like something you care about.
So here's the thing. When my dad was growing up, he had two best friends. One became a firefighter and one became an actor. So not that I had like a connection into the business, but I actually knew somebody. My Uncle Pete, you know, he was my dad's best friend, Peter Miller. He was an actor in the 50s. He was, you know, he had a little part in Rebel Without a Cause. He was in Robert Altman's first film, The Delinquents, and he had a great part in that. Did a bunch of TV when that was, you know, like really kind of coming into its own. And then he left and he became an investment banker. So by the time I wanted to sort of go into acting, he wasn't in the business anymore, but I would talk to him. And my idea was that I had to get out to Hollywood. Like, that's where you become an actor. I had no idea, you know. And my dad was, he was trying to keep me in New York so that when my name came up for the fire department, that I would be in New York. But he knew I liked acting. And he actually knew about acting classes because of Pete. Peter Miller went to the neighborhood playhouse. I think we did check that out, but then I ended up interviewing at the Lee Strasberg. But my dad also told me, you know, yeah, take acting classes because it's good just for life, you know. And I told him that on the interview, and I got a very stern look, you know, from the person interviewing me saying, no, if you come here, you have to want to be an actor. I was like, yeah, yeah, of course I do. Yes, yes.
I mean, that's like the first thing they tell you at acting school. There's like a long series of classes for the first few weeks where just basically every teacher is just giving you a lecture on why you shouldn't become an actor.
Yeah.
But you made it through that.
I somehow, I had the money to pay for a full-time 6-month course, and I loved it. You know, it really—
Did you think you were good at it?
It took me a while to even do anything in the classes. I used to just sit there. But in one of the classes, they did improvisation, and I found that I was kind of okay at that. And then once I started, you know, doing some scene work, I just felt like I really, really loved it. One of the earliest scenes I did was from A View from the Bridge with Linda Hamilton. And it was exciting, you know. And then, you know, in acting class, you could, you know, you get to do things that maybe you wouldn't normally do in the course of your career. So, and it was also, I learned about playwrights that I knew nothing about, you know. So it was a huge education for me. And it was exciting and it was fun.
Did you have a particular aspiration or idea of what your career would be?
No. I mean, I knew I liked comedy and I had, you know, some designs on becoming a stand-up because I love stand-up comedy, and I would see that some stand-ups would then get a series or they would, you know, be a guest star on a series.
This was like in the late 70s when that was truly. It was like the era of get on Carson, get invited to the couch, your own sitcom.
Yeah. If you look at Freddie Prinze, he was 17 years old when he did The Tonight Show, and then he got his own series. I was You know, I mean, yeah, he was young, but he had, like, a life experience. I was this, you know, kid from Long Island, and I was trying to do stand-up at age 18. I used to sit in the back of the Improv in New York and just watch, you know, people like Paul Reiser and Jerry Seinfeld and Gilbert Gottfried, and every once in a while I would get on just late at night. But it was a great experience to, like, see them, and that's really what I wanted to do. But stand-up for me, it was hard for me to find my own voice. I didn't like the aloneness of it. And I realized, you know, once I started taking the acting classes, was that I liked being with other people, you know. And so a little later on, after I had moved to the East Village, I met people like Mark Boone Jr., and this wonderful comedian actor, Rockets Redglare, and who was in a lot of Jim Jarmusch's early films. And we all just started to write and perform our own work. So that was a huge thing for me, to not only be acting, but also to be writing and improvising, and then being in a community of people who were all just trying to do their own work. And yeah, this was like the early 80s in the East Village, and it was just an amazing time to be there because, you know, in terms of music and art, performance art, dance, and it took me a while to sort of find my way, but after a while, I was in the thick of it.
I found a clip of you and Mark Boone Jr., who had a double act for a long time, and I watched it. It's recorded in the late 80s, which I imagine was towards the end of your run. But it's such a great piece. It's like a 13-minute scene with the two of you. And it was like recorded on a, you know, maybe a prosumer VHS camcorder or something like that. Like, it's not the finest video, but I sat at my computer screen, watched on YouTube all the way through because I found it so compelling.
Oh, wow.
And it was a lot less, when I heard that you had been in a double act, I presumed something a lot jokier and stand-up-ier than what it actually is, which is very theater-y. It's a real scene.
Yeah, we never considered ourselves stand-ups. I mean, it was always these little theater pieces, mostly shorts, but we did do a couple of feature-length plays, and it was always infused with humor, but the humor came out of the characters' personalities or the situation that they were in.
So I'm going to play a little clip. So your character is a professional panhandler.
Yes.
His character is sort of, is apparently maybe a professional panhandler, but is dressed very nicely relative to you. You're wearing like torn jeans and a beanie and stuff like that, and he's wearing a coat and tie. And he comes up to you as you're asking passersby for change and giving them a line about your wallet got stolen and so forth, and asks you for money, which you're not nuts about.
If you're going to stick around here, maybe I should give you some advice, or else you're going to die out here, all right? Look, whenever somebody passes by, even if they don't give you nothing, all right, always say, have a nice day, God bless you, whatever. Because, I'll tell you what, even if they don't give you nothing, all right, because maybe they pass you by in the morning, right, they don't give you nothing, but if you're nice to them, then maybe later on their way back, they remember you, people appreciate a little courtesy. You know what I'm saying? You understand how it works? I mean, I kind of know this, you know. I mean, I know how to deal with people is what I'm trying to say, you know. Hey, what are you staring at? Huh? I ain't no freak. Get out of here. Hey, get out of here.
Come on, man. Get out of here, huh?
All right, it's all right. I know that guy.
Come on.
He's a creep. He's all right. Hey, have a nice day.
There was a point I read somewhere that the two of you were doing 40 minutes of material every week.
For a while. Do you remember the club Folk City? It was this music club, you know, in the Village.
Yeah, very well-known club.
Yeah, I mean, mostly a music club. But they had a comedy night each week. And then they had a theater night, and we were booked for months, like 3 months. And we had to come up with a new show each week. And we usually waited to the last minute. but that's when you get real inspiration. Yeah.
I mean, that is like bananas. It's hard enough to go ask somebody that writes for Saturday Night Live. It's hard enough to come up with 5 minutes of material a week, less half an hour, 40 minutes.
We recycled some earlier things. But yeah, but basically we would come up with, we really tried to come up with new material each week.
By that point, did you think, oh, I'm going to be a theater actor, or I'm going to be a film actor, or were you just happy to be doing stuff?
I was just happy to be doing anything. You know, the fact that I could perform was just everything to me. I mean, yeah, I had designs on wanting to do TV and at that time, independent film was just starting to come into its own, And yeah, I wanted to work with the people that I saw around me, like, Jim Jarmusch, Susan Seidelman, she was making films, and people like Betty Gordon and Sarah Driver, Eric Mitchell. And then I started to work with some of them, and that was very exciting.
Did you feel like you were as cool and sophisticated and accomplished as they were?
Oh, no. I really didn't know anything. I moved into the East Village, I think, around 1978, and because, the rent was so cheap. And it took me so long to realize that the scene was happening around me. And then I liked it, but I had no idea how to, approach it or how to get noticed. And I was very shy. And it was really just... I just got lucky that I had some good friends. One of them was a firefighter who lived in my building, Dennis Gordon. And he was a pretty hip guy, and he just knew, the places to go, and he would bring me along. And then he introduced me to another firefighter who was an actor, Dean Tulipane. He was doing some theater. And so I ended up, doing some stuff with him and his troupe. And slowly it just kind of snowballed. But I was, I was still in the fire department and kind of juggling doing that and then doing these shows and then starting to do film.
Your wife passed away last year and the two of you were married for like 30 years.
Yes.
You must have met her around that time.
Yeah. We lived across the street from each other on East 10th Street. And she was also doing work. She was a brilliant choreographer, dancer, performer, performance artist, filmmaker, and she combined everything. And we literally met on the street. I have to say, I was a little bit of a stalker because I lived across the street. Does it count as stalking if you're watching from your window? A little bit. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not like I was standing outside her building.
Yeah.
But I literally would just get up in the morning and see if she would be on the street, and I would notice what time she'd come out of her building. Then I had a dog, and I would hurry up and get my dog and walk the dog at that moment, hoping to see her. And I have to admit, I also knew roughly what time she'd be coming home from work. And again, I'd be out there with my dog, Chief. And those were the beginnings of these little conversations that we would have. And she had actually seen me in a play, John Jezerin, who was a brilliant playwright, director. He was doing a series at the time called Chang and a Void Moon. He would write a new show each week that we performed on Monday nights at the Pyramid Club. And then he was doing some other longer plays. One was called Dog's Eye View that we did at La Mama. And Joe saw that. Joe Andres, my wife. And she told me what she did. And so I would check her out. I fell in love with her when I first saw her. Seeing her on stage was just like, oh, my God. And she's also this, brilliant performer. So, yeah, that was a magical time.
Did you ever dance in one of her shows? She was maybe best known as a choreographer of kind of, event dances, like performance art dances with projections and stuff like that.
Yeah, I danced in a couple of her pieces, and she was a real taskmaster. And but it was great. I loved the precision of her work. A lot of dancers, you know, at that time, it was more. Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know a lot about dance, but more like free form or contact improv or, you know, choreography that I probably wouldn't know how to do. But Jo's choreography was very precise, and, you know, and she just taught me how to do it. And there were a couple of shows where I got to dance with her, and it was wonderful.
I want to play a clip from your film debut, which was a movie called Parting Glances from 1986. And I watched some bits of this online today. And number one, you were very pretty. You were a pretty dude.
Huh. Well, thank you.
Yeah, like your character in the film is like a rock singer.
Yeah.
And you wear it well.
Why, thank you.
You're a very convincing rock and roll heartthrob. And this was one of the first, this film came out in the mid-80s, 86, and it was one of the first independent films to deal directly with the AIDS crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, before we play this clip from it, how you ended up being in the movie.
Well, when Boone and I were doing the shows at Folk City, there was another troupe that they were doing shows there, mainly improv. And one of the actresses was named Kathy Kinney. And she took a liking to us, to Boone and I. And Kathy and I became pals. And she was friends with the Bill Sherwood, who wrote and directed Parting Glances. And he had been looking, you know, to fill this role of this character of Nick. And she told Bill about me, and he came to Folk City to see me perform. And then he asked me to audition for the film, which I did. And he told me that if he hadn't seen me already on stage, he would not have given me the part based on my audition. I guess I was terrible on the audition. But that's how it came about.
Your character had AIDS and was dying of AIDS. You must have, at the time, living where you did in that time and place, you must have known people who were sick.
Do you know, at that time, I only knew one person who was sick. I had certainly, you know, read about it, and there was like this, you know, fear in the air about, you know, how bad is this going to get? And I was reading about people being sick and dying. But at that point, I hadn't known anybody. It wasn't until a few years later that a lot of our friends that we knew in theater and the dance world and in the performance world were getting sick and dying. Bill Sherwood among them. You know, he only made the one film.
I just had a family friend pass away from complications of HIV, and he had been HIV positive since about when this movie came out.
Wow.
And had a rich and incredible life, you know, far outlived his own expectations, certainly.
Right.
Anyone else's as well. But I remember even being a kid as, you know, I was born in 1981, so this was really when I was like an elementary schooler.
Oh, wow.
That it was really heavy. And like, I remember it would be someone I knew at church was gone.
Right.
You know, someone that it was... I think sometimes for people who are younger or maybe didn't grow up in urban areas with big gay populations,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, it's kind of hard to describe how scary it was then. I mean, like, I, as somebody who had no idea basically what sex was because I was eight
right.
or nine.
Right.
Even for me, it was very scary because it was my neighbor and my mom's friend and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
It truly was scary, and especially in the beginning when there was so much that was unknown about it, and it truly was, it felt like it was a death sentence. If you had it, it meant, you know, you had like a year or two at best. And it really did, it kind of swept through the community that I was in. You know, we lost some really wonderful and talented people that it was very traumatic. You know, it was really, that was, I think, the roughest part of like living during that time, you know, was losing so many amazing people.
Let's play a scene from Parting Glances with my guest, Steve Buscemi. He plays in it a character named Nick, who is the ex of one of the leads, whose character's name is Michael. And they're friends and have some feelings for each other. And Michael is caring for Nick, who doesn't really have anybody else to care for him. And this scene is at Michael's partner Robert's going away party. Mm-hmm. He's going overseas, and Steve's character runs into a younger guy at the party.
Just met Michael. He was a freshman at NYU. So I'm hanging out in the village.
I'm a Columbia freshman.
Shut up a minute. So I'm hanging out in the village, and I'm a couple years older than Michael, and I see this Midwest nerdy type kid walking down the street. So I chat him up a little bit. He don't know anything. I mean, the whole scene is happening 4 blocks away from where he's going to school, and he don't even know it. So I show him around. You know, we go bar hopping that night. Terry had this place over on Barrow Street, so we go there as a party going on. Michael went wild. He almost flunked out his first year. We tore this town apart, man. That's what you need. Find somebody your own age. Get your hair messed up a little bit.
Even more with Steve Buscemi after the break. Stay with us. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Hey everyone, Mujan Zulfikari here with the cast of Mission to Zix.
Hello.
Our 4th season premiere is on February 19th, and for those of you who aren't familiar with the show, we decided to ask one of our characters to give you a quick recap of what's happened so far, so say hi,
C-53. Hello, how may I be of service?
C, could you tell us what's happening in the Zix Quadrant leading up to Season 4?
Certainly. The evil Nerit Bundeloy, not to be confused with the non-evil Nerit Bundeloy of Narration, murdered his fellow counselors and crowned himself Emperor of the Galaxy. With the help of myself and the rest of the crew of the Bartarian Jade, Zeman and I plucked Dexter Nott, the Emperor, and an ancient cosmic entity known as Beano, into a chasm aboard the gigantic Planet Crusher Crusher, a machine built to crush planet crushers, which in turn were designed to crush planets. The resulting implosion created a vast celestial object with unknown powers. We are currently in search of our former rebel commander, Sisu Gundu, who may yet reunite our fractured galaxy. Is that sufficient?
Yeah, all clear to me. Mission to Zix, Season 4, debuts on February 19th on Maximum Fun.
NPR Music wants to hear your songs. If you're an unsigned musician, enter the Tiny Desk Contest. Just send us a video of you playing an original song behind a desk by March 30th. Learn more at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.
Hey, Bullseye listeners, it's Jesse. I just wanted to break in here for a second and let you know that MaximumFun.org has a brand new show that I think you will really like. It is called Fanti. It's about that stuff in popular culture that we love, but maybe doesn't love us back. Our problematic faves, our favorite problematics. It's hosted by Travell Anderson and Jarrett Hill, and both of them are brilliant and hilarious, like deeply insightful into things, but also very, very funny. They're also really good pals. So the two of them have a wonderful, warm rapport. And I can't recommend this show highly enough. We've been working so hard on it. I really think you're going to like it. It's called Fanti. It's a combination of anti and fan. It's spelled F-A-N-T-I, and you can find it in your favorite podcatcher. And I encourage you to do so. The first episode is about Kevin Hart and his prodigious talent and his many half-assed apologies. And I think you'll really like it. So search for Fanti in your favorite podcast app. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Steve Buscemi, is an actor and director. He's starring on the TBS series Miracle Workers Dark Ages. It's running now on TBS. I think you kind of made your film career with Reservoir Dogs, which came out a few years later.
Absolutely.
And yeah. How did you get that part?
I auditioned for it twice. The first time I auditioned it was with Seymour Cassell. I was working with Seymour on Alexander Rockwell's film In the Soup, and they brought us in together. And then I guess a few weeks later, I got a call back. And like I said, I was not a great auditioner. So I just, you know, I wasn't sure at all if I was going to get the part. And then I was invited to do a workshop of a few scenes in the Sundance Lab. And Quentin was going to be there. But the condition was, you know, it didn't necessarily mean that I got the part. But I just wanted to go and I just wanted to work on the scenes. And if I didn't get the part, fine. And it was at Sundance that Quentin told me that I had the part. And that was very exciting because I really felt like I felt like the movie was special. I thought it was a really, you know, so uniquely written and very funny, but then also, you know, really horrifying, you know. and Quentin did that, you know, he did all of us actors a favor by putting, you know, our names up on the screen, you know, and like the opening credits, you know, like right below our faces. That really opened a lot of doors.
How did being in that movie change your career? What happened when you were in a very hot indie movie and your name was printed underneath your face in the, you know, introductory sequence?
Well, I mean, it was great because casting directors knew me now and more directors knew me. But even before that happened, for me, it was just a huge step to be working with people like Harvey Keitel, you know. Harvey, actually, he was one of the producers on the film, and he paid for Quentin and Lawrence Bender, the producer, to come to New York to see New York actors because they were going to cast it all out in L.A. So if Harvey hadn't have done that, I never would have even been considered for the film. And so just to be working with somebody like him and Eddie Bunker, who I knew from the movie Straight Time, that was, you know, Lawrence Tierney, and, you know, and I was just starting to get familiar with Tim Roth's work. And so for me, it was just very exciting to be in a movie like that and to work with that caliber of people, and then to be, you know, with Quentin, it was his first film. And his, you know, enthusiasm for what he was doing was sort of contagious. You know, we all felt excited to be doing this. So even if the film didn't, you know, make a splash, for me, it was already successful because I just, you know, loved doing it so much. And it really felt like, oh, I'm, you know, sort of in a bigger league now.
I feel like it really set a template for your later performances in that you have a remarkable quality of sweetness on screen. And I don't know, maybe it's because, you have such beautiful eyes. Like, this is one of your calling cards on screen. And maybe it comes from that. Maybe it's something you're doing on purpose. I don't know. But the fact that you are so convincingly sweet while also being able to be a murderous psychopath, really, like, I was thinking about what's the connection between the TV show and some of that past work, and it's that, like, you have such a convincing sweetness that, like, that is what, like, you had this series of roles where you were in some capacity murderous generally, but, like, the audience wants to stay with you.
But it's funny, I don't see it as, I mean, I'm glad you see, like, a sweetness in, like, Mr. Pink or my character in Fargo, because I don't see the sweetness in them.
But I mean, like, that's the thing that is special about the performances.
Well, but what I do feel like is that these guys, that they're real people, that nobody, you know, becomes a criminal because they think it's, you know, cool. You know, it's, there's a desperation behind it, and there's always a backstory that made me feel sympathetic towards, like, who this person might be. And so I always try and, you know, kind of keep that in mind.
Did you have to re-steer the ship away from psychopaths 5 years after after Reservoir Dogs?
Yeah, you know, after a while, it gets... I mean, I had played plenty before then, too, but just not in films that people really knew. But yeah, it was sort of a a thing with me. Whenever I would get a script, I would sort of like see what page I get beaten up on, or see what page that I'm trying to kill somebody, or when I get killed. And after a while, I was just like, I do have to steer this in another direction.
You just start looking for dads.
Yeah, or comedies or something, you know. I mean, I was so it was so much fun, like, you know, to work with Adam Sandler on his films, even though in his first film I did play a psychopath in Billy Madison. I love doing all sorts of genres and characters, and I think mixing it up is really important.
You have had so many memorable roles that I wish I had time to ask you about, but I want to focus on the creme de la creme, which is the time you were on 30 Rock.
Okay.
which is like maybe my favorite TV show of all time.
Yeah.
And on it, you were a private detective, a somewhat dopey private detective who... Yes.
For some reason, Alec Baldwin's character kept hiring.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it ended up becoming like this truly... Well, I'm going to play a scene from it, okay. And we will talk about it. The episode was called The Tuxedo Begins. And Alec Baldwin's character, Jack Donaghy, has his phone stolen at knife point in a construction tunnel. And he hires your character, who is a, you know, 55-ish year old Steve Buscemi, to recover the phone.
You got mugged, huh, Mr. Donaghy? And you caught the guy who did it. Good for you.
Oh, no, Len. Tracy is helping me with this. But I can see how you went there. I have a criminal skull shape. Len, Commissioner Kelly and I are friends. We have competing columns in Irish Arguments Weekly, America's Only, All Caps Magazine. But Ray hasn't returned my phone call, and I know that you were once a police officer.
I was part of a special task force of very young-looking cops who infiltrated high schools. How do you do, fellow kids?
What?
So I'm glad you called me, Mr. Donaghy. I checked with my contacts on the force and got you this free pamphlet.
Len.
But you know what's amazing about that is that, you know, that was really kind of like a throwaway, you know, like not seen. It was like 4 seconds.
Yeah, at most.
And I'm amazed that, you know, that it's had the traction that it's had like all these years.
How do you feel about the lasting testament of your brilliant artistic career almost certainly being you in a backwards baseball hat holding a skateboard off your shoulder saying, howdy do, fellow kids?
I'm holding 2 skateboards.
Oh, thank you.
I love it. I love it. And, you know, that character, it was either in the first or second season. And then I started directing a little bit on the show, and it was really just supposed to be like a one-off. And I rarely campaign for parts or, for, you know, but I remember talking to Robert Carlock, one of the creators of the show and brilliant writer, and I sort of was planting in his ear, like, can we bring him back? And I saw, like, the look on his face was like, yeah, okay. Why not? And then he did in a big way.
He's like, weird priority, but yeah. Okay. Well, Steve Buscemi, I'm so grateful to you for taking the time to be on Bullseye. I've so admired your work for so long, and it was really nice to get to talk to you.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to talk to you. Thank you.
Steve Buscemi, Miracle Workers, Dark Ages airs Tuesday nights on TBS. It is super funny. You can also check it out on TBS.com. That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is produced at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where some local teens were spotted by my colleague Daniel playing on the barge that's in the lake. I'm told, says here on this paper, folks around the office are calling them the Barge Boys. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We got help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows are Jordan Cowling and Kristen Bennett. Welcome to Kristen. Great to have her here in the office. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, also known as DJW. He makes all those beats for the show, and if you go over to Bandcamp, you can find a compilation he made of music from Bullseye that you can buy on a pay-what-you-will basis, and you can listen to it while you're studying or whatever. Freestyling, whatever you want. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Our thanks to The Go Team and to their label Memphis Industries for letting us use it. And one last thing, there are decades of interviews in the annals of Bullseye and its predecessor, The Sound of Young America. They're all on our website, MaximumFun.org. We also have a bunch of stuff with Simon Rich, who is the creator of Miracle Workers. Not just interviews, but also him reading a number of pieces he's written for his various spectacularly hilarious books. We are also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Keep up with the show there. And I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.